What are the first couple of questions?
Well, I mean, this wouldn't affect any of us, but do you live on the Upper East Side, the Lower West Side, mm-hmm. Inwood, et cetera? Are you a native New Yorker? If not, where'd you previously live?
Okay.
What do you do for a living?
What is your answer to that?
What do I do for a living? Yeah. Vodcast co-host.
Congratulations.
Thank you. As of today.
As of today.
Right. We will never give up. We will never concede. It doesn't happen. You don't
concede. I object to you getting what you do.
Welcome to the Trump Trials Sidebar, a new podcast from the Washington Post. Whether you're listening on your favorite podcast app or watching our show on YouTube, we're happy to have you with us. I'm Libby Casey, and I'm here with my Washington Post colleagues, Rhonda Colvin and James Homan. And we'll be here each week talking about former President Donald Trump's legal fights, both inside and outside of courtrooms. And they range from New York to Florida to Georgia and right here in Washington, D.C. Now, this is a huge historic week on the Trump trials front. So let's jump right in. It's been a little more than a year since Trump was indicted in Lower Manhattan. And as we record this, Donald Trump is in court. Rhonda, how major is that?
This is a big deal. And I know there is a temptation to just kind of forget about it. And it's just one of other cases. We've heard about this case for about a year right now. And I think there is that temptation for people to forget how important that this is. As you said, the first time a U.S. president is in court as a defendant. As a defendant, I've been thinking about the security apparatus that's around that courtroom right now and thinking of how the Secret Service has had to do some unprecedented things. They've never had to protect someone who is on trial like this. So that alone just shows you how important and historic this day is. And not only is Donald Trump a defendant, and I know this is going to sound very obvious, but he is also the presumptive nominee for one of our major parties in the country. So this is a huge deal. Even though it is one of four cases, it's a big deal. It's a big day.
You know, people often call this case the runt of the litter, James, because there are, as Rhonda said, four different cases that Trump is facing. Why is this the runt and why is it still important?
It's important because it is the first time a president has faced charges. It is the runt because it's the hardest case to prove. And it is the weakest case. Basically, Alvin Bragg, the Manhattan district attorney, is saying that Trump falsified business records. Normally, that would be a misdemeanor. The statute of limitations is actually passed on that. To be able to make this case a felony, he has to show that the business records were falsified in furtherance of another crime.
Yeah, I want to pause you there because this is often thought of as the hush money case.
Right.
So let's talk about the hush money, but what's actually at stake here? What is he actually charged with? Because it's very different.
Right, he's actually charged with basically, like, it's like lying on your taxes. It's like submitting a piece of paper, deducting something as legal expenses that was in fact hush money. It's not the actual hush money, but he has to show the prosecution that this was to commit another crime. And he actually has not formally said which crime. He said it could be three or four potential crimes we're going to see. And basically, that's to preempt the Trump people from saying he didn't commit this specific federal crime. So essentially, it's going to come down to campaign finance laws, which is that Trump allegedly directed the payment of this hush money and covered it up to prevent voters from knowing the full truth. That essentially, this was a campaign expense that wasn't recorded as such. And he has to prove both of those things, and he has to prove that Trump personally directed that this be done, not just that the records were falsified. So that is basically why it's considered the weakest of the cases. In fact, in the Manhattan District Attorney's Office, this wasn't even seen as the strongest case they had. They thought that they might have a stronger case going against Trump for overinflating the value of his various properties to get more favorable terms on loans. Ultimately, the New York Attorney General ended up pursuing that as a civil matter, not a criminal one.
On the Trump trial sidebar, we'll be talking with our colleagues who are in New York, who are sitting in court. But today, Rhonda, just paint us a picture of what is happening there and what it's like to have Donald Trump in the courtroom today?
Well, one big thing, and a lot of people have probably been wondering, is you are not going to see this televised. If you already have not understood that, you will not see this televised. That is a part of New York's laws. There are going to be cases or hearings that we will be able to see in Fulton County whenever that comes to fruition. But this particular case, you are not going to be able to follow until we get the reporting from inside. The great journalists who cover court proceedings are in there right now. They are giving us, as well as other news organizations, sort of the TikTok of how the day is shaping up, what it looks like. But we, of course, won't be able to follow that live. But this is a big deal when you think about New York, when you think about the setting that this is happening in Manhattan, which is one of the busiest places and cities on the globe. And they now had to figure out how to make sure that this is a secure zone. So there are going to be, of course, road closures around that courthouse. There is going to be sort of a three-prong security approach where you have the Secret Service handling Trump's commute every day into court, handling him physically inside and any sort of maneuvers that happen inside the courtroom or when he goes down stairwells. You also have court officers who are going to be in there. They will be seated on each bench, we are told, to sort of protect and kind of insulate the former president, especially against the aisles. You also have the folks on the outside, the NYPD, where you even have special forces who typically aren't out and about, but are part of sort of the command center to sort of make sure that this area is very secure. You're also going to have some things that we won't be able to see, which is some of these special forces are going to be scrubbing the internet, scrubbing some of the dark web to see if there are threats potentially that New York could face during this trial. This trial is going to last for weeks, maybe months. We just don't know yet. But to even think about how much security needs to be deployed for this type of situation, again, it just underscores how historic this is.
Let's talk about some of the...
There's an old saying in New York that it's like the only city where a president can come and it's unnoticed. You know, that it's just such a big city. It's always bustling. There's always something going on.
There's always dignitaries, famous people, world leaders and there. The UN is there. Right.
And this is like the exception to that rule, right? Everyone in Manhattan will know this is going on. They've diverted traffic patterns. It's going to cause significant inconvenience for people who are just moving through Manhattan, especially while the president is coming to and from the courthouse. He's going to be staying every night at Trump Tower.
Which and he has to be in court.
And he has to be in court, unless he can get an excused absence, but otherwise he has to be there. So this is going to go on for a while. He's not going to have to be in court on Wednesdays because they're not going to have the trial on Wednesdays. And on weekends, they're still planning to do rallies, but maybe closer to New York, where he'll fly to Pennsylvania instead of flying to Arizona or Nevada. But this is going to really dominate his life for the next couple of months.
So let's talk about Judge Juan Merchan, who's the judge overseeing this. What has he done so far, James, to sort of set some rules and basic parameters on this first day of court?
On the first day, he's basically trying to be no nonsense. There's some back and forth about is Trump violating the gag order with some of his posts on Truth Social, his social media platform.
Because there is a gag order in place.
And it says that he can't attack the prosecutors or the witnesses or the judge's family. And so there was a post where Trump attacked Michael Cohen, who's the star witness against him. And the prosecution came and said, we want Trump to be fined $1,000 every time he violates this gag order. But what the judge really was saying was, look, it was something that you would tell any defendant, but if you're disruptive, you can be removed from court and basically waive your right to be here. And you can be put in jail, essentially, if you are so unruly, as any other criminal defendant would be, we'll order you jailed. And he said, do you understand this? And Trump said yes. So it's sort of the no nonsense that everyone says the judge is characterized.
So Donald Trump is thinking about how he makes his presence known inside this courtroom. There are no cameras in there. But he will still be a presence, James, and not just on social media, but in the eyes of the jurors. Tell us about what we know about what he's going to do during sidebars.
So Trump's attorney, Todd Blanche, told the judge on Monday that the former president wants to be present for bench conferences during jury selection. So anyone who's watched a trial, that's where the lawyers go up and they're huddling with the judge. And maybe there's something that a juror has written down on their questionnaire, or there's something about a juror where there are follow-up questions. And normally it would just be the lawyers. And a defendant in New York, there's case law about this, but the defendant has the right to be part of this. It's unusual. Trump is asserting his right. So when a juror is being brought up individually to answer questions from the lawyers or the judge to follow up on something, Trump will be standing there, as close as you and I are. And that is, it's the former president of the United States. That is certainly going to have an effect. That is his right. Not every jurisdiction allows this. New York does. And it's going to mean that someone could be talking about very private information about themselves. And Trump's going to be standing there and hearing it. Mm. Does that affect how you behave or what you say? We'll see.
So that gets us to our word of the week. Every week we'll tackle a new word. This one is actually a phrase, voir dire. So let's talk about the voir dire process and what it is. What does it mean literally, Rhonda?
Literally is a French term that means to tell the truth. So this is the point in a trial where the lawyers, also the judge, can sort of get at if a juror or potential juror can be impartial, if they have the ability to listen to all the evidence and then make a decision. That is what is going on right now. That's the phrase used in any court proceeding to select a jury, to see the jury.
Jury selection is going to be a very intense part of this process. And this case could really hinge, James, and Rhonda, on just which jurors are picked. Is that fair to say?
Very fair to say. I mean, I heard it classified this way earlier today by a jury consultant who said, when have you ever seen 12 people agree on anything? So of course, in the judicial process, if there is just one juror who disagrees, then that opens up a mistrial. So that really is all that the Trump team needs, is just one person who wavers and won't agree with the 11 other jurors. So yeah, this is incredibly important. And remember, and to state the obvious, Donald Trump is known to everyone. He is very much known to New Yorkers. And depending on their age as well, they may have thoughts about him that they've known about him for years.
Let's talk about what's on the juror's questionnaire. Yeah. James, you have it in front of you.
I do. It's 7 pages. Yep. It's 42 questions. And to Rhonda's point, I mean, think about it. Like, everyone knew who Bill Cosby was, too. But people didn't most people love Donald Trump or hate Donald Trump. The people have strong opinions.
A lot of people have years of Facebook posts right. going either way about exactly. how they felt about the presidential election.
This isn't just your average famous person. This is like someone who is so polarizing, who it feels like it'd be very hard to find people who don't have like really firm pre-existing opinions on either way. Mm-hmm. So this juror questionnaire tries to get at that, which is, so basically they summoned 500 potential jurors. It's mm-hmm. a huge number of people, wow. even in Manhattan. They had them all show up today. And after a few hours of motions, they brought them in and they said, if you don't think you can be impartial, like, let us know. And normally you would follow up with those people and maybe say, like, you could be impartial and figure out what they mean. They're just going to automatically dismiss the people.
I just want to pause that yeah. for a moment, because Rhonda and I were talking about this. I mean, in that normal process, someone might say, yeah, I can't be impartial. Yeah. But Rhonda, there'd be a follow up. There'd be a dialogue. Mm-hmm. And we've all seen jurors sort of be convinced, actually, I can be. Okay, I can do this, right?
And that won't exist in this particular trial. So, and then the judge has the last say. So after this process goes through with each individual person, he will weigh in on whether or not to seat them. So that is a little bit different yeah. from what others might know.
Yeah,
about
and each side has 10 peremptory strikes. So that they but both sides, the Trump team and the Manhattan District Attorney, can try to dismiss people for cause, which is basically like in your jury questionnaire, if you said, yeah, I volunteer for Trump on the weekends and I gave Trump, I give him $100 a month to his campaign, or I listened to Steve Bannon's podcast, then the prosecution could move to strike you for cause. Mm-hmm. They don't have to explain why. I think to your point, Libby, like this case really could be, maybe will be, won or lost in jury selection. We have some reporting on what Trump's lawyers are looking for as they wade through this. Because, again, you know, the criminal defense lawyers like to say that the prosecution needs to convince 12 jurors. Mm-hmm. The defense needs to convince one juror. And a hung jury is a win for Donald Trump. And so you think about, like, who are the people? Because it's also withstanding peer pressure, right? If it's 11 to 1, you want the person who's, like, willing to be like, no, mm-hmm. I'm not going to convict this guy, even when everyone is sort of pushing you. So we know from sources that Trump's goal is to focus on younger African-American men and white working class men who have some indication that they may be kind of against the system or may feel like Trump is being targeted, and that they can, if they can get a handful of those on the jury, that might make the difference between winning and losing. Todd Blanche, Trump's lawyer, has told the former president that he thinks that's their path to being able to beat the rap.
Well, a duo of our colleagues, Michael Cadenhead and Ozzie Paborough, went to New York to talk with Manhattanites, regular New Yorkers, to see if they felt like they could be impartial jurors. Such a great question. Michael joins us now. Michael, what did people tell you? What was the main thing that you heard?
Well, the main thing that we heard, I think overall, Manhattaners, a lot of them were honest about the fact that they couldn't be impartial, because there were so many, like, just clear, strong opinions about Trump. You know, there was not really a lot of in between. People either really loved him or really hated him.
Were you asking them, can you be an impartial juror?
Yeah, we were asking them if they could be an impartial juror. But, you know, I think what became the main question, or the question they really wanted to answer, was, do they like Trump or not? You know, so we started. Started with a, you know, can you be an impartial juror? And they almost like skipped that question, like, well, I like Trump or I don't like Trump. We're like, no, but can you be impartial? So that definitely made for a more interesting conversation, because, you know, you could see them kind of like, well, could I? I hate him, but I could be an impartial juror. So it was really interesting.
Let's listen to some of what they told you.
It's not like he's someone that you don't know, and he's so divisive that you either love him or hate him. And because he was the president, everyone already knows who he is.
Yeah, I have a strong impression of him in office. It was a pretty shitty time.
I like him. I agree with everything that he has said, because what he said is true. It has to be true. It can't be false, because if it's false, then he can be brung up on charges.
What do you think when you hear that tape?
Very New York. You really got a mix of the Big Apple. I heard that you ran into Sting's wife while you were at the recording. Is that
not Sting's wife? We saw who we thought. You know, she did not stop, so we cannot confirm. But it was pretty. It looked like David Bowie's widow. Yeah, the supermodel Iman.
Yeah, she's the person in her own right, guys. Iman. Yes.
Right, exactly. Yes. I was going to see. Yeah. So I was.
That's a very New York trip. It's not New York unless you see Iman on the street. Yeah, right.
Exactly. Yeah, that was. I was hoping that she would circle the block so that we can ask her if she could be an impartial juror, but she did not. But we got a really, like you said, a really mix of people. Even though the opinions were polar opposite, they definitely were just indicative of New Yorkers. The next tape that I guess that we'll be showing really shows how, you know, before Trump became a national figure, he really has deep roots and has left a lasting impression as a New Yorker before even becoming president or a politician.
Roll the tape.
Yeah.
Do you remember the first time you had an impression or awareness of Donald Trump?
You know, he was young and brash and showing up in the gossip papers a lot and, you know, associated with certain buildings and associated with certain women. And
I know the projects that he did, and I knew people that worked for him, so I knew what his reputation was. I also tried out for The Apprentice, so...
Nice thing to drop there. Somebody tried out for The Apprentice.
And he kind of buried the lead. He was talking about, like, I've worked with this person, I worked that person, and I tried to be on The Apprentice. So it was really interesting. And we, you know, there were people that we, you know, we did not use their videos, but, you know, like I said, Trump has, you know, deep ties with these people. So it's really going to be an interesting, you know, question whether or not, you know, can people truly be impartial or have like a total objective opinion about Trump with all of these, you know, impressions that he has put on people.
Yeah, Rhonda, Michael gets at such an important point. America has a relationship with Trump, but New Yorkers have an even deeper and longer relationship with Donald Trump.
Yeah, that goes on for decades. And especially if you talk to older New Yorkers, like the woman you spoke to, they have all sorts of different associations or experiences with Trump just being in the city. I mean, think about, you know, he sort of represented that modern gilded age with, you know, the golden Trump Tower. Everyone passes by it on Fifth Avenue. People knew about other real estate deals and other projects in the city. I've even heard, you know, there are members of Congress who have even thought like something is going to catch up with him one day just based on his real estate experiences in New York. He is well known to New Yorkers. He was sort of part of the fabric as a celebrity.
And he also inserted himself into politics, including in people's lives in the Central Park Five case.
Yeah,
he was
exactly.
Very accusatory of those young men who were eventually exonerated.
Right, right.
And has never owned up to that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so he has a cultural background and baggage there as well, in addition to sort of that lux image that he tried to cultivate.
Yeah, with the Central Park Five, you know, when he was president, he was asked to apologize for that because people did feel like he had some sort of influence over that case and the rush prosecution of the five. So, Donald Trump in New York, there is a special relationship there. He's from Queens, so he is a lifelong New Yorker, although not a Manhattanite. But it is so interesting to hear those folks' takeaways. And also, just as you pointed out, every American has an experience now with Donald Trump. He affects most of everyone's life in one way or the other. Certainly when he was president, every choice he made affected everyone. So that's another reason why this is so, it's important to cover this case, follow it, because we've never seen anything like this. And we can't forget that. We can't just act like this is status quo. We've never had a president as a defendant.
And now this case will be in the hands eventually of 12 jurors, 6 alternates. What are your impressions or takeaways after talking to so many New Yorkers about their feelings about Donald Trump?
I'm just going to be interested to see how this plays out. I feel like a lot of the people we talked to weren't necessarily understanding what the case was about or kind of forgot, you know, the details, you know, from early on. And I'm just going to be interested in seeing, you know, all of these details that were once, you know, prominent in the news, you know, how they play out.
That's so interesting. So they weren't more keyed in than the rest of America about, oh, this is the New York case and these are the New York charges.
Well, not only did they not necessarily know the details of the New York case, they got, you know, this case mixed up with, you know, the other cases Trump is facing. So it's going to be really interesting how it plays out in public, the court of public opinion, you know, while these other cases play out and while we approach the election.
All right, Michael Cadenhead, his story and his video is on our website. It's also in print. It's right behind your head, James, if you want to pick it up. It's like the trifecta, I think, when you get photos and print
video.
And video and everything.
Nice, double truck, as we call it in the business. There's a great video that you should watch, but a great display.
Great. Thanks so much.
Nice mix of New Yorkers.
Thanks so much, Michael.
Great job, Michael.
Thank you all.
Moving on to our reader mailbag, where we'll take a few of your questions each week. You can submit them by emailing us. It's sidebar@washpost.com. We took one of today's questions from our Trump Trials newsletter, and I've got one of my own, guys. Here's mine. Will we see Donald Trump testify? James, what do you think?
Trump says he's going to testify. It, I think, is one of the big question marks going into this trial. I think it will depend on two things. The first is the prosecution gets to go first, right? So some of it will depend on how Trump is feeling. Michael Cohen, his former fixer, who has become his kind of avowed enemy, is going to testify against him. I think that will certainly shape into his calculus. And then also, will Trump's defense team get the judge to limit how much ground the prosecution can cover during their cross-examination?
That gets us to another great question, which is just how much salacious material, because as we've said, many people think of this as the hush money case, even though that's not what he's actually on trial for, technically. Mm-hmm. But Rhonda, there's a whole salacious, I fill in the blank word backstory about this. How much of that will be let in?
Yeah, that's right. And there's one name that isn't really talked about, but is part of the charges in the indictment, and that's Karen McDougal. She was also in the adult entertainment industry, and she had a lengthy affair, allegedly, with the former president. The Stormy Daniels incident, that was, that kind of centers on one encounter that they had in 2005. But the McDougal affair, that went on for a while. So will the jury in the courtroom be able to hear more about that?
The judge ruled that, and this has been one of the big question marks. The judge just ruled that Karen McDougal can testify, partly because they did the catch and kill with her too, where the National Enquirer sort of bought her story and then didn't run with it, but she was
on purpose.
Exactly.
They pay for it in order to be able to control it and kill it.
Exactly, to help Trump win. But the judge said, and so it's sort of a mixed ruling. So Karen McDougal will testify. She'll talk about how her affair was covered up. The prosecution will not be able to introduce that they were having this affair and that Trump was allegedly sleeping with her while his wife Melania was pregnant with their son Barron. The defense said that that would be overly prejudicial. Similarly, the judge ruled that the Access Hollywood tape that the Washington Post scooped in October 2016, the tape cannot be shown, but they can say what Trump said on the tape. Mm-hmm. The judge said it would be prejudicial to
this
the
jury.
This
is where he talked about grabbing women.
Women.
Right.
And then the other thing the judge ruled on Monday during the first day is that the jury can see an email exchange between Trump senior staff when Dave Ferenthal, our former colleague here at the Post, reached out to them and said, we're going to run this story. Basically, the freak out that ensued about how do we get this under control, because the judge said that does get at the state of mind on the campaign, with a willingness to kind of try to pay off Stormy Daniels and to try to cover it up for the purposes of winning the campaign. Because one of the things Trump's lawyers can say is the reason they paid Stormy Daniels is so that Melania wouldn't find out about it, which wouldn't be a campaign finance crime. And the prosecution will say, no, he was trying to pay her off so that the voters wouldn't hear about it before the 2016 election. So that's where the Access Hollywood emails become super relevant, and the jury will get to hear Hope Hicks emailing with other staff about what Trump was saying and how they were going to try to control the story.
And all these people you're talking about are people that were likely to see testify.
Yes.
Like Hope Hicks. Yeah. Rhonda, another question for you. Since the New York hush money trial is a criminal trial, could Trump go to jail if he's convicted?
Well, with these charges, it would face up to 4 years in jail. However, it is, from my understanding, and of course, we're not lawyers, but from my understanding, these type of charges don't usually lead to jail time. But that is a part of the consideration, that it could lead to jail time. We just don't know what will happen.
Yeah, it seems unlikely in this case, but he's not immune from going to jail as a former president or as a presidential candidate.
No, he's not immune from going to jail. He's also not immune from running for president or being president in jail. That's something that a lot of people might be surprised about, but that's nowhere in the Constitution, that he could not be in jail and also be president.
The other thing is he cannot pardon himself for this. He could order the federal charges dropped or rescinded. He can't pardon himself if he's convicted in Manhattan.
That's true. Yeah.
Or in Georgia.
I just wanted to jump on the part about Access Hollywood. I think people, because this happened over the course of, years, the actual incident was in 2006 or 2005, 2006. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then it didn't come to light until Donald Trump was running for president. You have to remember the crucial weeks. That was in October when the Access Hollywood tape came out.
Of 2016, as he's
right.
running
I was
for
here
president.
In the newsroom that day when we published that video. And I looked back a few days ago, I looked back at the polling after the Access Hollywood tape came out. And you do see that Hillary Clinton did get a bump from that. People were kind of, drawing away from Donald Trump. There was concern that his evangelical voter base would not, they would prefer him not to be president at that time once that tape came out. So the fact that that will be, at least the transcripts or the written version of the Access Hollywood tape, will be a part of what jurors will be able to remember, that's going to be pretty important. It is a crucial piece of all of this, because would Trump have paid, or Michael Cohen, paid Stormy Daniels to silence her story if that tape had not surfaced? We're not sure, but the timing is something that you can expect Alvin Bragg and his team to really focus on, because it shows that this was an election decision, a campaign decision, versus something that he was just trying to hide, you know, from personal embarrassment or the embarrassment of his family.
Yeah. I mean, part of the damning evidence against Trump here is that there was communications about, like, let's just push this off until after the election. It's fine if it comes out after the election. Let's try to buy time, drag this out. And that sort of supports the thesis that he sure wouldn't have authorized these payments if not for the election. And that gets to this idea that it was to further this election crime, the misdemeanor falsifying business records in furtherance of this other crime, that makes it a felony.
That's all we have time for today, guys. James Homan, Rhonda Colvin, and Michael Cadenhead, thanks to all of you. We'll be back on Thursday with another episode of the Trump Trials Sidebar. In the meantime, keep up with all of the Washington Post's coverage. We're at WashingtonPost.com, and subscribe to all of our episodes on YouTube, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts. Thanks for being with us. I'm Libby Casey.
Yeah, can you keep my photo up there on this monitor my parents?
Well, no, they'll take a picture for you. That way, you don't have to be like a selfie and selfie.
Okay.
Like just put your phone down and look natural. Can someone take a picture?
That's good.
Yes.